Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 156. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. I have the awesome regular crew here. John Lindemann.
Hey.
James Jones.
Hey.
And Greg Lay.
Oi, oi, everyone. Sorry, just trying to keep up with you, John. It was very fast.
No problem. So, we got everybody here, and we got a really fun show today, actually. We're gonna have some new business with a pretty interesting array of games, I think, including, of course, Wii Sports Resort, the big win from last week. And then in the second segment, we're going to do a feature topic about the state of virtual console. And when Greg and I were talking about this, I said, I don't want any lists of games that you should download or that we want to download or that we want to be on virtual console or that we bought and we don't like. Nothing like that. It's going to be more philosophical, more, I don't want to say historical because it's not been around that long. But we're going to talk about kind of how it's worked out so far, what we think the future is, actually what we think the present is probably a better question, but we'll get to that. And then after another break, we're going to have your listener mail. So actually, really interesting listener mail this week. All four letters are from people who I don't believe have ever written into the show before. So get some new voices here. It's going to be exciting. And of course, we start with new business, what we've been playing or doing in the past week. And I would like John Lindemann to go first.
All right. I'm currently a little bit financially behind the eight ball. So what I've been doing is kind of scouring for game deals. And one of the games I picked up recently for the PSP is Resistance Retribution, which is a first-person shooter made by the same guys that I believe did Siphon Filter. It's Sony,
yeah,
Sony Bend.
I think they did the PSP Siphon Filter,
yeah.
Not the original.
Yep. And anybody that's been on the forums knows that I'm a fan of the Resistance series. And it's very good. The only thing, of course, that sucks is because there's no dual analog control or dual stick control
now,
on the PSP.
Retribution is kind of different from the PS3 games, though, because it's third person, right?
No, it's first person. It is. You're right. It's third person, but I mean, it's...
John, have you played the game?
Oh, you're right, Johnny. It is a puzzle game. I didn't realize it until just now.
Oh, wait, it is an RPG. Hold on.
It is a dating sim.
Wait, I haven't even been playing Chrono Trigger all this time. I've been playing Resistance Retribution.
Sorry, man. I'm just messing with you. But, you like it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good.
Resistance card battles games.
You know, the thing is, I mean, you have to use the face buttons to control the camera and your aiming, which is kind of goofy. So it kind of makes the play kind of stilted, I guess. Like, I don't know. It has some auto aiming. It has an auto aiming mechanism.
Yeah, there's got to be a ton of auto aim.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. But
is it good auto aiming or bad auto aiming?
It's good auto aiming. It's definitely good. Yeah, I mean, it always amazes me. Like the PSP can still crank out the graphics. It's a really, really nice looking game. I was actually surprised at the amount of high quality movie scenes that were in it and the amount of story that they actually set it up with. I mean, the opening cinema is like a good minute long, more than that probably. And that's even more than most of the console games. So, and apparently there's a lot of like multiplayer, like it has full online multiplayer and kind of stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to playing through that when I get a chance. Probably won't be for a while, but it was $20, so I figured I'd pick it up.
Nice.
And also, another game I got on sale, but unfortunately I did not get it, is Rhythm Heaven. It was on sale on Amazon for $13, so I could not pass that up. But
whoa, I would get that. I'm going to have to check that later, because I'm real iffy on Rhythm Heaven. I don't think I would like it as much as you guys, but for $13, I would totally like to have that.
I mean, it seems worth the risk.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, pop it in every now and then and whatever.
Yeah.
$13, that's insane.
Well, it was an Amazon deal of the day, so...
So you've already lost out, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. I'd keep an eye on Amazon, because they have some really, really good deals on. Like, just out of nowhere, there'll be a really good game on there.
The problem is that the deals are so good that they're going to trick me into buying a lot of stuff that I wouldn't have bought otherwise, and I might not even really care about, but I buy it just because it's a good deal, and I can't really afford to do that.
Well, in cases like that, I would say it's a safe risk, because... You know, it's generally regarded well, and there's at least a fair amount of playtime in them.
Yeah, I mean,
it's when you get into those games where it's kind of a 50-50 marginal thing is where you run into problems, I think.
Yeah, and I also shy away from anything like with any console games. I mean, even if a game that's normally 60 is on sale for 40, I'm not going to pick that up. You know, because the thing is, in six months it'll drop down. If it's not a game that I want to play right away, it'll drop down further in 6 months. So. It has to be a game that I really, really want.
And I think that goes to what I had said at one point of never paying $60 for a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no point. I mean, unless you absolutely positively have to play it on the day of launch.
Yeah.
Because especially the 360 and PS3 games, they tend to drop price pretty quickly.
Yeah, definitely. For example, I'm not going to be picking up the Modern Warfare 2 Prestige one with the night vision goggles.
Bullshit,
which
man.
I think is the most ridiculous pack-in I've ever seen.
It's the best pack-in.
This is just John's attempt to put his past as the killer from Silence of the Lambs behind him.
I'm done with that, man.
Well, I'll tell you right now, it's not their deal of the day, but the deal of the hour.
Mm-hmm.
Really good for you. It's a Pfalzgraf Verona 16-piece dinerware set.
Sweet.
Served four.
Nice.
$39.
The Hut's a steal. That's a steal. Hold on, I'm going to put down my headset.
Moving on from silverware, John, have you gotten any farther in Chrono Trigger?
I haven't played that for a couple of days. I think the last thing I did was I'm at the part where you escape your execution. I think that was the last thing I did.
Mm-hmm. He's got 407 hours logged in it now.
Yeah, I'm about 1,000 hours in it right now.
Didn't you love the trial scene, though?
Yeah. See, and that's the kind of thing, that's why, is it just me, or is that kind of drama really not in RPGs aside from, you know, Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger? It's just those kinds of scenes where it's almost campy, but I don't know. There's a certain feel that those Squaresoft RPGs
have. I feel
have.
That it's not really campy at all. I never felt it was campy.
The music is quite playful. It's
yeah,
very
it is.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's very nice. I like it a lot, but it is playful. It's kind of, you know, it's not like, oh my god, he might die.
No.
You know, it's kind of like, this trial is kind of silly and, you know,
it's
farcical.
It's more tongue-in-cheek, probably, than campy.
Yeah, it's not really dramatic, because you know he's not going to die, obviously.
Uh-huh.
Right, and I think that's part of...
make a very short game.
The crazy thing about Chrono Trigger, I'm not sure if John is fully aware of this, but it was this amazing... combination of guys who worked on Final Fantasy and guys who worked on Dragon Quest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this was years and years and years before Square and Enix merged. So this was a very unusual mixture of talent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certainly a lot of Final Fantasy in that game. And the music especially, I think, leans more to the Final Fantasy side.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the lightheartedness of the story and the sort of cartoony nature of it, where it's like everything, you know, the game is overall quite serious. I mean, you're dealing with the end of the world, and I would even say that the end of the world feels more palpable in Chrono Trigger than it does in all the other RPGs where you're trying to avoid the end of the world.
Well, because you get to see it.
Yeah. So it's really brilliant the way they handle that.
But in this case, it's even more kind of campy, because not only is it the end of the world, it's the end of the world caused by a giant ceramic porcupine. I mean, it's...
Ceramic? Why ceramic?
Stop spoilers! Stop spoilers!
Well, compare this to Final Fantasy VI. I mean, John, we're not spoiling much because you're very, very close to seeing this. But very soon after where you are, you go to the future, basically after the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to the ruined future where everything's really fucked up, right? Everything's destroyed. There are almost no people left. There's really no reason to keep living. And compare that to what the world of ruin in Final Fantasy VI, where the world was sort of destroyed, except it seems like things really aren't that bad afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no time travel in Final Fantasy VI, so you're really fighting to save the world, whatever's left of it.
Yeah,
right?
Things just kind of suck in Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah, you know, you're still trying to save the world. It's just that the world is not really as worth saving as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
And in Chrono Trigger, you see what that future's like, and you go back and you actually try to prevent that from happening. And also, I would say that what they show you in the future in Chrono Trigger is a lot more dire and depressing and philosophically bold than what you see in Final Fantasy VI. I mean, you see people starving in Chrono Trigger. And it may seem a little comical when you go back and play it now, but I mean, when I was younger and I played through that the first time, I really felt the hunger of those characters. And I really felt that... I mean, I did. I was, you know, I was 10 or 12.
Sure.
And I really felt the depression and the weight of that future bearing down on these characters. And I really wanted to do something about it. And I never really felt like that in VI. Final Fantasy VI, because the damage had already been done. Really, there's not that much you can do about it.
Yeah, well, like, would you say that the kind of lighthearted tone that I think is, you know, definitely in that and also in Final Fantasy VI, would you say that kind of gives more of a like a stark contrast, like basically makes it more effective, more depressing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then
say FF7, which is just way overblown.
That's, I mean, that's, you know, it's very interesting that you use the phrase lightheartedness, because that's kind of, well, I mean, it really is why I'm not as enchanted with Final Fantasy games as I used to be, because they're just all big, overblown, serious. There's no tongue-in-cheek part. I just don't
find
them.
They take themselves too seriously.
Yeah, I don't find them very endearing anymore. Like, I don't find any of the characters endearing.
Exactly.
Well, I would say, to make clear here, I would say that there was one game that did that in the since 7, and I'd be 9, where it was was pretty tongue in cheek.
That was pretty much the point of it, though, was to go back and recapture that essence of the old ones. And I think they kind of failed in 9, by the way. I think 9 is, I mean, it is more lighthearted, but the characters aren't really more interesting.
9's just not a compelling title to me.
So, I don't know, we might have just blown Greg's mind a little bit. He's not as familiar with all these games.
All these games I've never played.
Chrono Trigger I'm intimately familiar with, but when the frame of reference is Final Fantasy, then I'm lost.
Anyway, so I'll go next for new business, and I've been incredibly busy this week with all kinds of stuff and just haven't had time to play many games. I did go pick up Klonoa, finally. I got a GameStop gift card, and I said, you know, here's a game that I probably wouldn't go out and pay $30 for, but I don't mind spending someone else's $30 on it. Because I wanted to play it, you know? Mm. And it seemed like a fun game to own, to pull out and you know, show other people when they come over. I heard that there were some kind of bonus modes, you know, some reasons to play through it more than once. And so it seemed like, yeah, I could rent that, but it's already so cheap. I feel kind of stupid renting a game that's only $20 or $30. I'd rather rent a game that's $60, basically, $50 or $60. Hmm. So anyway, I picked up Klonoa. I did play the original PS1 version of Klonoa a long time ago. And it's funny because I think my feelings about it back then really closely mirror my feelings about it now, which is like the first couple levels, I think, oh my god, why does everybody like this so much? It's just so simple and so very, very childish in the presentation, the story and the characters and everything. And the level design, the gameplay just really isn't, it's not all that compelling in the beginning. But then you get to maybe the third or the fourth level, and it ends up being just a very, very, very gentle curve into awesomeness. And I think what I remember from the first time I played it is that by the end of the game, I was pretty amazed by it. And I'm not that far in the Wii version yet, but I can feel it ramping up, and I can feel that I'm getting more and more into it, and the levels are becoming more challenging, more interesting, more, you know, thoughtful. But it's weird because, and Greg, you have this too, right?
I have this. I've finished it, yeah.
If you've never played Klonoa and you want a frame of reference, best comparison, or the closest thing I can think of, is Kirby 64. The game is very Kirby-like in how colorful it is, how charming it is, how innocent it is. It's very easy, especially in the beginning. And the level designs start off making you think, oh god, this might be just as bad as Kirby. I mean, it just seems like the first couple levels, there's not much in them. It's just pretty much run from left to right until you get to the end. But they're just easing you into it, because as you get a little farther into it, the level design really builds up into places that just blow away any Kirby game. And it starts to feel less like Kirby, more like Mario, I think, as you get
I think there's definite parallels with Yoshi's Island as well, because of the flutter jumper, because of the little medallions, which are a lot like the flowers that you'd collect in Yoshi's Island and things. But it does get so much more interesting at the end, and you know, the more puzzle elements using the enemies and things sort of become more integral to the game and stuff. But unfortunately, it's not too bad, because you don't end up paying very much for this game, you know, as you've kind of said. But it's just a shame that it doesn't go on like that for a while longer, or perhaps given the length of the game, you know, the gentle part of the curve was a bit shorter, because you just feel like, yeah, there's mileage in this, you know, there's more, and it never quite gets there, you know, as much as you'd like, because it did spend so much time being kind of very easy in the beginning.
It kind of ends right as soon as it's getting good.
I mean, maybe they only had, you know, so much time or so many ideas back when it was originally made, and I haven't played any of the sequels or anything, but it just seems like, you know, yeah, this is a really, you know, in terms of the core mechanics and everything, it's a really solid idea for a platformer. and there's a lot more you could do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think everybody's hoping that they'll make a sequel for Wii, you know, now that they've done this one. I mean, there is a sequel. There's a Klonoa 2 on PS2, which I don't think is very good. I've played only a very little of it. I've watched a friend play more of it, and I was not impressed at all. And then I've heard that the there's a couple on GBA. One of them is a puzzle game or something weird, but the other one is actually a platformer, and I've heard it's actually very good, but I haven't played it.
Yeah, that got good reviews, as I recall.
I'd like to check that out sometime, but Klonoa is really good. Now, the one thing I don't understand is that, you know, you can shake the remote to do some kind of whirlwind effect, and I can't figure out what that's used for.
I would liken it to stunning the enemies in Mario Galaxy with the star bits.
Really?
It's sort of like that. What it does, it slows enemies down. It doesn't quite stun them. But it is essentially the same thing. It's like, I'm guessing it's for, you know, very inexperienced gamers that might have trouble.
Are you implying that it makes an easy game even easier?
Well, but you don't have to use it. I never did. Beyond once.
Yeah, completely optional.
I used it once to see what it did, and then when I understood what was going on, it was like, okay, I'll never use it. It was the same with Mario Galaxy. I never stunned enemies with the star bits after sort of realizing what that was about. Because it's just like, well, I don't need this. I'll just play it without it.
Okay, cool. So Greg is next.
Yep. Okay.
You've been resorting
Wii Sports Resort. I mean, I don't have a whole lot to add. I know James has got it, so maybe we'll kind of exchange thoughts.
Click.
Yeah. It's been a good time playing more multiplayer and things. The sword play continues to be the star of the show. But in terms of the new stuff that I managed to play, I went on the Nintendo channel in Japan, this newly refurbished Nintendo channel. I was actually hoping for a Japanese demo of the new Chibi-Robo game, which just came out there, because I thought that could be quite interesting. I've never played a Chibi-Robo game, but I like all the stuff that Skip's done that I've played, so that I thought that'd be nice, but no luck, unfortunately.
Is that Nintendo published?
Yeah.
Oh, it'll be on there eventually.
You would think so, yeah.
They're usually like a week or so behind. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, because speaking of which, what I did find was Tingle's Balloon Trip of
Yes!
So this also very recently came out in Japan to a pretty good reception. I think it got a 34 from Famitsu.
This is the mini application?
No. This is the new sort of sequel to the previous Tingle game that came out in Japan and Europe.
Okay.
It's what I played of it, at least. I don't really know that much about the whole game, but the part that I played was basically like a point-and-click adventure. So he was like in this sort of almost like a crazy farm with an old couple, and I was just searching around and sort of trying to find stuff. Obviously, it was quite text leveraged, so I didn't really understand what the hell was going on with all the Japanese text. But I mean, you could tell things like the art style really is quite cool, actually. It's quite nice. And there was some little sort of things you could do, like there was you go in the old couple's bedroom, and on the dresser there was a few objects, and you click around, and it didn't really, that wasn't so much where the text was, it was more in the conversations, like, but you could sort of poke around with the objects, and one of them was this big mushroom, and I just looked at it, and I noticed there was a hammer object, so I just thought, oh, let's bang the mushroom with a hammer, and it turned out it was like a piggy bank. And so I just nicked off with a bunch of rupees.
And that's the goal of the game, right?
Well, it was the goal of the first one, for sure. It was all about rupees. Like, rupees were your life. You used rupees to, like, pay people to fight for you. All sorts of weird things.
Just like in India.
That is the currency in India, isn't it?
nice explanation for our listeners.
Yeah.
It was smooth. Yeah, it wasn't
racist.
Just to be clear,
Greg's just covering my back from ignorant
people. Not saying that Indian people can't fight. I mean, look at Great Tiger, and I mean, that is most definitely not a racist character at all.
That's right. I mean, look, they say he's great.
Well, there really is a national dialogue now. There's an international dialogue about race. It's so great.
It's seeping into everything.
From
India specifically.
Yeah, it's more national, I suppose. But yeah. So I just poked around for a little while longer, didn't really understand what was going on. I think I made progress at one point. I found a key. I never really found what it opened. At one point, the old man slapped tingle in the face.
You don't want to know what that key opens, Greg.
Maybe I inadvertently said something very offensive when I was picking one of four
you
options.
This game.
maybe you asked him to slap you.
Exactly. You don't know. I mean, it is weird. And like, for some reason, when you have a yes or no option, like, it has a little animation almost previewing the yes, which is him doing like a rocking out kind of thing. It's like, what?
So
when I think of tingle, I don't think of him being some sort of death metal guy or anything, really. I think if he were at, let's say, a Megadeth concert, he would get the shit beaten out of him. Let's not be around the bush.
just in case we didn't clearly state the title of this game, the literal translation is Ripening Tingle's Balloon Trip of Love.
Yeah.
Which is alarming.
I know. I don't understand
what,
it at all.
Who or what does Tingle love?
Euphemisms galore
other than
there.
Fairies.
I think it is about Tingle trying to find a mate. But I don't really
a fairy?
Know any more than
no,
that.
No, he wants to become a fairy.
The prospects are not good.
You know, apparently Famitsu thinks it's good. I don't know what that's worth anymore, but...
it's kind of relative.
I think it's safe to say this will probably never come to America. I guess the question is just whether it'll come out in Europe again. I don't know how well Tingle sold.
I don't think it did particularly well.
Probably not. But apparently it did well enough in Japan to get a sequel. So this is what... I said it before, I think, but you know, this is what they're doing instead of F-Zero on DS, people. It's a Tingle sequel.
Let's all hope for a... English version of the new Tingle game.
Oh, God, yes.
For Europe, at least, you know.
Yeah,
so we
well, then
it.
You could always import it.
That's right. All right, so James is going to wrap up new business, and he's got Wii Sports Resort, which I wish I was playing, but I don't have anyone to play it here this summer, so I'm going to wait till I get back.
I've mostly single-playered it. I've gotten some multiplayer time in.
Mm-hmm. So you do have two Motion Pluses.
Yeah, I bought a second one while I was there. So
Did you just buy it individually? Because I obviously had mine with Tiger.
Yeah, I bought mine individually, yeah. So I got one with the Wii Sports, and I bought another one. All right, so I know you played sword fighting the most, or fencing, whatever they
call it. Yeah, certainly on my own, because you got the showdown mode.
Yeah, I played that for a while, and then, because that was what I had the most fun with at E3, and I decided, well, I should probably go play other stuff. I'm going to say about a third of the games in Wii Sports Resort will never be played by anyone ever.
No, I don't. I think if you're talking about a different third, if you're talking about a different third for different people, maybe. But I think you can never account fully for taste, is what I'm saying. You know,
Power Cruising. Do you really see there being somebody who says, "Man, I want to play Power Cruising"?
Yeah, the wave race style is. The
yeah,
Power Cruising,
it, well, it's
isn't it?
It's
yeah.
not just that. It's not. It's not fun.
So it's not the second coming of wave race.
It certainly isn't. It's just like you. Do you remember the Dolphin Cove or whatever it was?
Yeah.
In Wave Race, the trainings, that's what it is.
Yes, okay. Over and over again.
Yeah, but it just gets slightly more complicated. Yeah. Like, so they'll have rings suspended in the air, so you have to do a little jump on a wave to get through it or something. I mean, that from what I've played, I haven't quite played all of that.
Yeah, it's just not an exciting experience.
Oh, hey, did you try the Segway racing? And I put racing in quotation marks for Wii Fit Plus.
Yeah, I did.
Other than
that.
Watching worms crawl across a finish line, it is just awful.
It was amusing in the stupidity of it, I think.
Yeah, well, that's all those New Balance games seem to be about making you seem stupid. Some of them are fun, and then some of them aren't, but the common factor is stupidity.
To go off track here, was especially amusing because you got to watch people with this super intent look on their face as they literally were just standing there. So they'd have like this really super serious look, but they weren't really doing anything. But to get back to the game that actually is out.
Yeah.
I think that game, the Frisbee game, is pretty dry.
I mean, I could see. Frisbee golf is all well and good. I mean, the thing is, I've got Tiger, so that has Frisbee golf and it has actual golf courses. So you know, but for people that don't have Tiger, like the
basic
cool,
mode of Frisbee is pretty dry. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good like that's almost like a training thing.
It's
as well.
A tech demo.
It's just like, but like in terms of for playing Frisbee golf, it could be a training thing. It's like, okay, so you practice like if I want you know how to bend your throws and yeah. Hit certain spots and things.
Just remember that Disc Dog, or something similar to it, was the primary mode of gameplay in Nintendogs.
Yes.
So, how spoiled are we now?
Exactly, we got loads of stuff now.
It's just a throwaway in Wii Sports Resort.
I have actually had a fair amount of fun with the flying game.
So you've just been the bit where you spot things, like the little landmarks.
Yeah, because I feel like...
That sounds like fun to me. That sounds like jumping in the gyrocopter or whatever in Pilot Wing 64 and just exploring.
And there is a lot of stuff to see. It's like 80 spots of interest.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow,
I think so. Huge. Yeah, and I mean, some of them are kind of... I mean, it's like some of them are little jokes. Like one of them is you go towards the hotel and I saw three... nice looking, you know, striking hard tennis courts. And we're like, well, there's no tennis in this game. And then you get there and it says, if you want to play tennis, unfortunately, all the balls have been stolen.
Oh, that's right. There you go. There is another weird one about, like, there's this arch way out in the middle of the ocean that it takes like a third of your time to fly to. Because you only have 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And there's one there. And when you fly through it, it says something like, isn't it great that there's an identical arch on the other side of the island? And then I think to myself, oh, you bastard. So basically, I started flying top speed, which basically meant I thrusted the remote over and over again.
Yeah, so it's got this little boost. Like that's one of the annoying things, because there's a time limit. So yes. You want to get around as quickly as possible to some of these different places, see as much as you can. So if you really want to, you know, put the pedal to the metal, you've got to go, you know, jab in it like a, you know, jackhammer. It's just, yeah, who wants to do that?
John's head is going to explode.
Thrusting aside, that sounds really fun to me because I love flying games. I mean, do you guys remember exploring the island in Diddy Kong Racing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was really fun.
The only thing I can say about that is don't hold it like they want you to hold it, which is like a paper airplane. Just hold it normal. I mean,
that's how I've done it.
It works fine.
And you could do a barrel roll as well, which
you
is
can,
very important.
Yes. And you can shoot off fireworks. That's amusing. Yeah,
well, there's a flare, and you kind of earn the ability to shoot balloons, which becomes like a separate thing of the game. Like every like cars have balloons, people hold balloons, other airplanes have them, and it's just kind of like how many can you pop.
You unlock extra functionality of your airplane every 10 items you find, which is kind of cool.
So in this game, in this the flying game, can you see your Miis running around the island on the ground?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can
see that's awesome.
And you can see everything. Awesome. I mean, it's all there. That's what's one of the coolest things. It really does bring it all together. I mean, yeah, you can literally fly into the sort of the crack of doom in the volcano where you have the final archery challenge. You can fly in there even.
Yes.
You know? I mean, you can go anywhere that you see in all the other modes. It's all there, and it kind of...
That's awesome.
That's really cool.
It's really cool, that.
So the tunnel in the bicycle race that goes around the mountain, you can actually fly through the tunnel all the way down the highway to the other end.
Oh, that's neat.
Which is a little bit of a tricky flying, except for the fact that if you bounce around, you're fine.
Yeah.
You have to really, like I said,
it's really liberal with the controls and all that. You know, I guess, I mean, I can't remember, with the gyrocopter in Pilot Wings was probably like the most liberal kind of vehicle, I guess. As I remember.
Oh, yeah.
It was the easiest to fly.
Exactly. So that was kind of the point of that. So that is a good analogy in that case.
But you could shoot missiles in Pilot Wings.
And there was that robotic version of the guy with the tash that you could kill with it.
You can shoot balloons.
Shoot balloons, yeah.
Balloons, missiles, what's the difference?
I've tried the dogfight, which is kind of cool, you know, because it's not amazing or anything. It's like you have a balloon on your back and it can take so many hits, basically.
Yeah.
But if you crash, it costs you a certain number of balloons, but they will at some point like spawn a spot that you can get more balloons, which is kind of good because it kind of forces you to converge.
Yeah.
Rather, because you've got this big island and only two planes, you could kind of just, you know, be ships passing the night.
You could Star Fox 64 it and be on the other sides of this building and just sort of fly around.
Yeah. So it's good that at times they drop something in that says, right, go to the, you know, you both want to go and get this. You're both going to have to, you know, duke it out for that. So that's a good choice. I mean, it's basic, but it's kind of, it's neat that they put it in there. If it wasn't in there, you'd say, oh, wouldn't it be nice to do this? So it's good that they put it in.
Now, I think I'm going to be in a minority here, but the other game I've actually really enjoyed is it's one of the basketball modes. It's 3-on-3.
The 3-on-3. Yeah, I've dabbled in this a bit. You know? So you've got like you've got passing involved in it. You know, was it A and the D pad?
Yeah.
Zach's review said you can make your Miis dunk.
You can make your Miis dunk.
Yeah.
And not only do they dunk, they thunder dunk.
Nice.
they go up. Strong, two hands on the rim, come down.
It seems like you could do a pretty good dunk competition, a slam dunk competition with Motion Plus. Just saying. Well, maybe in the well, next at, NBA.
At the end, the announcer goes, "What a dunk!" or something like that.
It's so inappropriate with that guy that sounds like he was rescued from Super Monkey Ball. It's just like he should not be talking about dunks.
It's like,
that's
what
not
a dunk.
Right.
Ready, start. Oh, the guy from Super Monkey Ball is. Oh, man.
See, but I actually, when I first started playing the basketball game, I've heard people complain that it just kind of feels like you just throw it up and it goes in or it doesn't. But as I worked on it and played it a bit, there's actually a lot of minute control that goes on in that game.
You would hope so.
So it's like,
I think you notice it more in the 3-on-3 because you shoot from different spots.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, when you do the free throw stuff, it's not literally from the free throw line, obviously it's from the 3-point line.
Yeah.
But you know, you are always shooting from that spot, that you're just from different points around it. But whereas with this, you know, if you pass to a guy that's closer in or whatever, it changes it. So you don't. It is. Yeah, in that sense, better than I first thought.
Yeah, and you can put rotation on the ball, which will help, just like in real shooting, with how the ball lands in the hoop.
Now, it doesn't have horse, does it?
It doesn't.
I wonder if that's just a cultural thing. Maybe the Japanese people just don't play horse, or they're not as familiar with it, and so...
One thing to note, though, is that you can play defense while you're not on there, so you can block,
yeah,
and you can steal.
Jump up.
And it just so happened that Evan... is one of them was I got from the parade of
Mies. Oh, the Mies. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it just so happened that Evan popped up as one of my defenders. And Evan is a defensive MVP. He is like the premier lockdown swingman, apparently. He got like 5 steals and 8 blocks in one game.
I have so few
dude's
normal
a madman.
Mies. They're all like E.T., Venom, Vader. You know, they're just all bizarre.
So did you connect to the Check Me Out channel? Because I heard that you can do
you
that.
You can.
Yeah, you can do
it. That's
really cool. Really cool feature.
Yeah.
It does also have a disclaimer about that, unsurprisingly.
Yes, you might end up with someone with whistles.
What we call the BJ principle.
They're going to make me re-download Check Me Out. Deleted
well,
that shit
is,
a long time ago.
That would have been a complete non-starter before the SD card fix. But
yeah, because,
no,
I mean,
right,
why would you even keep that stupid thing around?
No, that was right. One of the first things to go.
You, gone.
Exactly. Everybody votes in the chat. Yeah, that's
check
stuff
this out,
gone,
bitch.
Gone, gone.
Now, James, what do you think about, where do you stand on the whole stamps thing in terms of,
oh,
so you've got,
yeah,
achievements.
It's like achievements, but... No.
But you can't, it's not, obviously, it's only for this game, and you can't really mail people anything, or, like, you know, I thought maybe, like, it might be a bit like, if you finish Super Mario Galaxy, like, with Luigi or whatever, you get a different picture to your message boards, which I guess you could send to your Wii friends and say, look, you know, this
look at this
I
bitch.
Yeah.
And Metroid Prime 3 also, you do that.
Yeah, that's true. So they've done it in Mario Kart Wii and this sort of thing, so it'd be kind of cool if there was a similar sort of thing with the stamps, but obviously I haven't got them all yet, or probably
well,
never will.
What the thing I don't like about the stamps is, I know in most achievements that they don't tell you what they are, like what you have to do to get them, mm-hmm. but some of them are truly random. Like there's one for 3-point contest where it's not that you do well, it's just that you finish quickly.
Yeah, so, that's true, and some are cumulative, like just play it for a while, like how many arrows go in the board over the total time you played the game, for instance, in archery.
Yeah.
Those are really boring.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, well, I think that's the thing. It's like a mix, though, of different stuff. You know, like some are like just, you know, for playing it for... It's a bit like Smash Brothers in that way.
Yeah.
I mean, because a lot of the ones, it's like trophies and stuff for Smash Brothers, just like you play for this. Like, so they are the minority, though. Most of them are some sort of... You know, a trick or, you know, some sort of feat of skill or whatever related,
yeah,
to it. And it's kind of cool to have something to aim for. Like with there's a return challenge sort of mini game on the table tennis. And, you know, I don't know whether you'd necessarily come back to that many times.
Not really.
When it's like, oh, look, there's something for getting 100. All right, I'll try that. I'll try getting to 100 for a little while. And then you end
up...
Yeah,
well, that's when achievements work.
Yeah,
and
that's why I think that it is generally a good idea. I mean, you know, obviously it's not going to be the same as with Xbox where it's all integrated and everything, but I'm still glad it's in there because, again, you know, this is primarily a multiplayer thing. Although, of course, if you register all your Miis and stuff, you could kind of compare between your family,
yep,
because it's tied to your Mii who got the stamps.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So you can view them within the game, then?
Yeah, like, pretty much, like, before every game starts...
There's a little icon, yeah.
It has a little icon of what stamps you have. and you can check.
I thought
what
maybe
ones
they just
get.
Only get shown on the message board.
No. It's pretty good about that.
So, okay. All right, what's your take on biking?
I tried it actually for the first time today. I just hadn't got around to it yet. And I mean, yeah, the problem is, I mean, it's basically like the sort of, you know, the track and field running that's
just
been in any number of games. You know, like Mario and Sonic DS, which I reviewed many months ago now, has a virtually identical system in terms of the three hearts.
Oh.
And, you know, you get fatigued and then you have to lay off it and then they recharge and then you start again. I mean, the one thing it's got is the slipstreaming that helps you recover.
Yeah, I always felt like I was either boosting or coasting. Like, I couldn't find that in-between area.
That's true, actually. Yeah, you never quite find a sweet spot. It's always sort of speed up, slow down, speed up, slow down. But, yeah, I mean, look, that sort of thing doesn't really appeal to me very much. And it's certainly, like, motion plus for this, really. You know?
Well, the worst is I went and I played all three races back to back to back.
Why would you do that?
Because I was just hacking my way through the modes.
Right.
And I was just physically in pain. I mean, it was...
Yeah, well, you would be.
Well, and the worst part is, then you can unlock three consecutive races. We get to race the whole fucking island on a bike, back to back to
that's
back.
All like that. Was it the Mario Kart double dash thing where it put all 16 together in one cup? Like, it's just yes. Like that. Oh, good.
It is cool in that you get to see the island from a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that is the cool thing about the island, really, is that... Even some of the events that are not necessarily like you like, it's just kind of cool to see all the, you know, to see all the different facets.
Yeah, it's not just a theme they threw in there just for the sake of saying, oh, it's got a theme now.
No, it feels very thought out.
Yeah,
it does, and it makes the whole game feel a little less sort of slapped together and a bit, you know, even though certainly some of them, like I said, I mean, you know, cycling is very incongruous because it is so not motion plus.
No, it is.
The interesting thing is, you know, Wii Fit and Wii Fit Plus are on the same island as Wii Sports Resort.
Are they really?
So, yeah,
I think
that's the island comes from Wii Fit. That's the
idea. I didn't see. I've never played Wii Fit, so I didn't realize that.
But I guess you've never got to. So, you know, the idea would be you didn't really see it before, whereas now, like,
you didn't. Right.
You didn't get to tour it.
You didn't see much of it. You would only see it in the running game,
the jogging,
in Wii Fit,
yeah.
Which is crap. You know, I mean, it's not good. So most people never have really seen it before. But I mean, that was really the only reason to do running in Wii Fit, is that you got to see the island, and it's pretty cool. I mean, it's like, oh wow, this really feels like it's almost like a Mario game. It's almost like a Mario 64 experience. It dumps you in this big world and you kind of explore it.
It's also got a sort of pretty Hyrule castle looking thing built into the mountain at one point and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, but like,
yeah,
like
really
when
nice.
The first time I flew through town, which literally I flew through town because I'm an asshole and I like to just come in at like head length.
And there are certain points that are at that height as well.
Yeah,
you know?
I
will have to do that if you want to find them.
I crashed into a tower and my first thought was, did they just take... Is this set on the Sunshine Island?
Yeah, the lighthouse. Yeah, it is very... Yeah, it'll remind you of Delfino for sure. There's a little house that I crashed into that you can hear, like, NES sound effects coming
out.
Oh,
yeah, and there's one place where I was flying and all I heard was Mario's, yee-haw! Coming from somewhere. Really? I was like, what the hell is that?
It actually was the death jingle from Mario, and the info on it is, it sounds like someone's playing in the NES there, but they're dying a lot.
That's pretty funny.
Nice. Well, this is, it all sounds really good.
I'm very surprised, I'll put it that way.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business for us, so we're going to take a quick break, be back with a feature topic on the state of virtual console. Hey, welcome back, everybody. We wanted to talk about Virtual Console this week. for a few reasons, I guess. I mean, the service has been out for as long as the Wii, so, you know, encroaching upon 3 years. And we've got over 300 games in both America and Europe, and over, actually, nearly 500 in Japan. And the reason that it's been on our minds a little bit the past couple weeks is because, in America at least, the flow, the very consistent, not consistent, but it's there. It's always been there. The flow of Virtual Console games. Every week, there's at least one, sometimes two, used to be three or four back in the good old days. But the past 2 weeks in America, we've had zero. And it's the first time that's happened since the WiiWare launch, which was a special occasion. But you can kind of understand on the WiiWare launch, where they launched, what, 5, 6, 7 WiiWare games in America, that they didn't want any Virtual Console stuff to kind of interfere with that, or to get pushed aside, you know, to get ignored because of the big launch. But the past 2 weeks have not been any kind of special event at all.
Yeah, well, it has been a special event. It's been the special F Virtual Console event, clearly.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, Virtual Console has been... there was certainly been long stretches where we weren't very happy with which games were being released. but it has been a constant presence in the life of the Wii. I mean, for me personally, and I know for Greg, and probably for John and James as well, it is so intimately tied with our concept of what the Wii is. I mean, when I turn on my Wii, there's at least a 1/3 probability that I'm going to play something on Virtual Console. I might boot up a WiiWare game now that there's some good ones out there and I've downloaded them, or I might do a disc. You know, I might play a disc game, but there's a very high probability I'm going to play something on Virtual Console. So, I mean, to me, it is very much part of the system. It's part of the reason I play Wii as much as I do. And it feels like, we don't know for sure, but it feels like that era might be coming to a close. Or at the very least, we're experiencing a stutter in the life of the Virtual Console. So I kind of wanted to bring it up and talk about what we think of this. And let's start with the most recent development. Why do you guys think that we have had gone 2 weeks now without a Virtual Console game?
I think Nintendo's out of games. I just don't think they're in the games.
That's the obvious answer.
They definitely don't have Smash Brothers, Mario Kart, both versions of Pilot Wings. You know? Yeah.
WiiWare probably has a lot to do with it. It just seems like they're much more intent on spacing out releases than they are in Japan. They kind of... almost like they view it like they have a certain cap of content that they can put out each week, and like maybe like, you know, they have 5 parts in any week, and you know, a WiiWare game is 2 parts, and another WiiWare game is another 2 parts, and then part, that's a Virtual Console game, and that's it.
Well, Heracles Chariot Racing was definitely not 2 parts.
It's a 4 part for sure.
Had to get it in there. I mean, it's an interesting point, because in Europe, they did, when WiiWare started, they did things a little differently, in the sense that they would actually have alternating weeks. So it'd be, you know, a week of WiiWare where usually 2 WiiWare games would come out, and then a week of Virtual Console where 2 Virtual Console games would come out. So on average, it was the same as the US. And again, you've got this idea of kind of like, look, we'll only release so much in a week. They did it a little differently. But then the Japan experience is so, so different.
Everything out now.
If you trace it all the way back, in Japan, they launched the service with 38 games. Mm-hmm. Which is compared to, I think, about 12 in America. So it's a very, very different approach. And that really kind of started to really show itself after WiiWare came out, because Japan still regularly has 2 VC games a week, but it's not as if they have less WiiWare. I mean, they might have different WiiWare. It might not be like, you know, Pong Toss or whatever Western stuff that we get, but you know, it's Muscle March. It's, you know, they still get
basically
plenty
the same
of
game.
WiiWare games. So it's not as if that. It just seems like they are quite content. If it's, especially with DSi, when if it's going to be 6 in a week, 7, so be it. They don't seem to have the same concerns. And what's strange about that is you say to yourself, well, what is it about Japan that makes them think that that's viable there, but not in the West?
Do you think games are selling more maybe in Japan?
I'm sure they are.
Yeah, really? Download games? I mean, I don't think of Japan as being on the forefront
of
downloadable content.
They would
content.
Have to be, or Nintendo wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, it's always the shortest distance between two points in the commercial sense is the pure market force element. But I do tend to agree with John. It's a little perplexing. It's somewhat difficult to connect the dots on that.
Their internet culture isn't quite the same place.
Well, I know that Nintendo seemed to, and I mean, you can interpret this a number of ways, but Nintendo have had more initiatives in Japan to actually get people online with their Wiis.
That's true.
They've done stuff like a friend sort of thing. Like if you introduce your friend to getting online on Wii, you get 500 Nintendo points or something like that.
And then also in Europe, you can exchange your Club Nintendo stuff for Wii points.
Yeah.
And in America, there's nothing like that. I've heard something about a Pepsi promotion going on this summer, but I don't know much about it.
Yeah, it's basically cap tops, and I think a certain number of them win Wii points or something. I don't know.
But that's it. So it seems like in Japan, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could interpret it a few different ways. It seems to me like they may be thinking, well, you know, not enough people are taking this online. We've got to get them online. Not, oh God, you know, we're swimming in download sales.
See, I think I just don't think that's the Nintendo that we know. Where they usually they're like, well, that's not making us money. Canned.
Yeah.
Or that's making us money. Let's make 18 of those. Just in there. In their previous psychology, I would have to infer that if they're doing this with such high volumes in Japan, there must be getting some reward that they aren't getting here.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think it could also be an element of Japan's cultural experience with resale of old games, because now you're starting to hear more about it, where a lot of publishers are complaining more and more about how games are being resold, you know, especially at mall stores. But in Japan, there have been lawsuits over this going back 20 years, where they actually tried to make it illegal to resell games. And of course, those efforts failed, and that's why you have stores like Super Potato.
But that's a whole different...
Well, I mean, download game, you know, things like Virtual Console are, among other things, designed to destroy the resale market.
Well, no, that's not what I mean, though. I mean, that's a whole different monster than what we have here, where... In most places that resell games, it's this generation.
It's the contemporary stuff,
right?
Yeah,
so,
the substitute
like,
for the retail retailers of today.
And if they do sell other stuff, it's all just tossed in a bin somewhere in the middle of the store, and it's 10 cents a cartridge.
Yeah, not with the sort of the preserved packaging and all that, you know, kind of stuff like Matt was talking about a couple of weeks ago.
I would be inclined to say that in a culture where things like Super Potato exist, you would expect to see lower sales in that regard. But maybe it's sort of a cross-cultural thing. Well, the games are available in their physical form, but the reason they are available is a desire to play them that exists.
I think the answer to the dearth of Virtual Console lately, and the trickle down to literally nothing the past couple weeks is probably not cultural, and it's more about, number one, Nintendo of America not having their shit together, which they really haven't since the beginning of Virtual Console in America.
Yeah, it's been all over the place. Especially when we've heard of games where the publisher of a game will think that it's coming out this week. Like the what was that snafu with the one SNK game? The Neo Geo game?
Yeah, it was definitely a Neo Geo game.
Yeah, that stuff, yeah.
They thought it was going to come out, and then at the very last minute, Nintendo switched on them. Yeah, stuff like that.
There's a lot of scheduling stuff, and you know that could have been a technical issue. They may have found a bug in the emulation. They need to go back and fix it and delay it a week, and we just never heard the resolution. But definitely a lot of secrecy, a lot of confusion about how Virtual Console works, why certain games are chosen. I mean, Nintendo's really never said anything publicly about why does this particular game get released on this week, or why did it take a year to get this game out in America when it's been out in Japan?
Translation.
I think there's a lot of NOA just not knowing, just not managing it well. I don't think they really have a dedicated team who cares about Virtual Console. I think they have like one poor sap who has to try to manage it with no budget and no help.
And then he has people with things like California games coming to his door.
Hey, watch it, buddy. But like, what do you think though? The one thing that is different in the North American market is that effectively, in terms of the downloadable content that people have access to, I mean, really, you have Xbox Live is huge over here, and so PSN to a lesser degree, but the thing is, you kind of have that third competitor, whereas in Japan, Xbox Live is certainly not as big in Japan as it is here. You know?
Yeah.
So exactly, I mean, there's only a million Xbox 360s in Japan. So I'm just wondering.
What is interesting to mention though, in terms of drawing some parallels, is that, you know, in terms of the number of downloadable games on PSN is also vastly greater in Japan than it is in America.
Oh yeah. The you mean the original PlayStation?
Yeah, the original PS1 games.
Yeah.
They are like it's not even close. I mean, it makes the differential in the virtual console that we've talked about, you know, look small.
Well, and that might have to do with the relative health of the consoles in the different markets.
Well, possibly, yeah. But still, you wonder sort of what the factor is there. But I mean, yeah, I think in America, you almost get into a point where, you know, is it a sort of chicken and the egg thing? Is it, are they not particularly sort of going forward with virtual console because it isn't as lucrative as they'd like it to be? But on the other hand, you know, if they applied more effort in the areas of marketing and, you know,
we say it about them all the time, though.
Could they actually make it more lucrative if they were willing to sort of put themselves out there a bit more?
Yeah, but I mean, look, we can all nitpick Nintendo marketing from one title to the next, but overall, their marketing has been sensationally effective this generation.
Exactly. Amazing.
Except with Virtual Console and WiiWare, I would say. Their downloads... average person doesn't even know that Wii goes online. It's just really not conveyed at all to the public.
Well, that's the thing. Do you think that Nintendo kind of views Virtual Console, and this could possibly be part of why they're scaling it back a bit, is do you think that it only appeals to the hardcore old-school Nintendo fan?
Well, no, because if that were the case, they would be scaling back WiiWare stuff, too.
But WiiWare stuff is new, though.
Yeah, but
the service itself. I'm saying the content.
But it would probably still appeal to the same people.
If you look at this is really thin information to go on, but if you look at the most popular titles on the Wii Shop channel for Virtual Console, they're pretty mainstream stuff, you know, basically the Mario and the Zelda games. I mean, I'm not saying those games are ultra casual or anything.
But they are, you know, some of the biggest selling games of all time. We talk Super Mario Brothers 3. I mean,
that's not surprising. I mean, that's what we would have expected coming in.
No, but the point is, if it were just the old school hardcore Nintendo fans, they bought those games years ago.
They're not buying them now.
So the point is, if they're still at the top, it's not those people that are buying them to make them at the top.
Well, I mean, they could just be buying them so they can play them on their nice their new TVs, or, you know, or just because it's an impulse buy. They don't want to go dig a thing out of their attic.
I'm saying they bought those games when they came out on virtual console.
Probably,
Super Mario Brothers came out in 2006. Super Mario Bros. 3 came out in 2007. I mean, that's the point. They're at the top of the chart now because people bought them last week. And those people are not the hardcore Nintendo fans. They've had their Wii since launch, and they've purchased all the games, you know, very soon to when they came out.
If that's true, then that kind of disproves what I was just saying, that people aren't going, you know, the average Wii purchaser is not going on the shop channel to look at virtual console stuff. So, I mean, the thing is, because of the tools like Most Popular, which is, you know, I'm sure pretty heavily used, the shop channel is very poorly laid out to highlight games. So it really only highlights the stuff that was added most recently, which is usually trash that even we haven't heard of, at least over the past year or two.
Hey,
gonna keep going.
So you're either gonna click on that and see the newest editions, which you're not gonna want to download, or you're gonna go to Most Popular, which is Super Mario Brothers and Super Mario Brothers 3. And I mean, that's the stuff that people download because they know it's there.
They know it's there and they know what it is.
Because that's the other issue.
I mean, with the new stuff, it's not always bad by any means. I mean, even now, you've got some credible Majora's Mask a few months ago,
Pulse Man. There's some good stuff.
But they may need more explanation than
Super
Mario Brothers 3.
And the shop channel's not going to give you much. I mean, it gives you like a couple tiny screenshots.
They need demos.
No demos and no video. Yeah. I mean, really.
Demos, I don't think are going to happen, especially with the really old games.
In Japan, the Nintendo channel always has a video of the virtual console updates. But it happened once in America, and that was
for Super Mario RPG.
They need that.
The trailer that they use is just the track sequence that plays in the game at the title screen.
Nice.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, at least they pulled that out. But that was so momentous, I wrote a news story about it when it happened. I was like, holy shit, there's virtual console on the
and that was
Nintendo
the last
channel.
News story. He
no,
ever
but that's
wrote.
It is interesting because in Japan the videos are very insubstantial. They are like, you know, the first 30 to 60 seconds of the game, but they're always there for every game every week. And so, I mean, it's a, it does suggest that there is a fundamentally very different approach here. It's like, we're going to actively encourage people to get online. We're going to actively promote it through the Nintendo channel, which seems like the obvious place to promote it because, well, you have to be online with your Wii to see the Nintendo channel and to go to the Wii Shop channel. So there's a natural complementarity between the two. So, I mean, it's the obvious venue. It is perplexing why there isn't more promotion in America to me.
Well, I think the real, to get back to the question of why no virtual console games, and why even before that, going back farther, why so few over the, why is the number trickled down? I mean, the trend really, really, really kicked into gear when WiiWare launched. And at first, they were content to kind of balance them out because there wasn't a whole lot of stuff coming out on WiiWare. A lot of it wasn't that great. So I think they tried to balance it out with some virtual console stuff. But now you've got not only WiiWare, which is really, really heavily ramped up, and we're getting four or five WiiWare games a week. It's insane. I think it's fantastic, even though most of them are not things I'd be interested in. Some of them are, and it's pretty amazing the quantity of WiiWare games. I really didn't think it would ever get quite like this. So you've got that, but now you've also got DSi stuff, and that's the strange
that's
one to
right,
me because
I need my clocks.
Well, it seems to have had, regardless of the fact that a lot of the DSiWare stuff is very trivial in nature, and also that it's on a different platform.
It's a different platform.
It really
platform,
should
yeah.
not be competing with virtual console stuff, and yet it does. I mean, there's a very tangible trend here.
I could see it in America from the point of view that the only substantial promotional channel outside of the Wii Shop channel itself is the press release. And the press release,
and it's getting long.
And the press release has DSiWare on it too. So in that sense, there is actually a sort of tangible rivalry between the two.
And they've moved Virtual Console all the way down to the bottom of the press release.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I mean, if you look at the past 2 weeks of press releases on Nintendo Download, there's no Virtual Console, but they're full of other stuff. And I think that's really the key here, is that Nintendo, at this point, every week, and you know, they don't even list the new songs for Rock Band and Guitar Hero and Samba de Amigo and stuff like that. Mm. So I think there's just so much download stuff coming out every week now that Nintendo can't keep up with it using their old marketing methods, and they don't know how to deal with this much content. They're afraid that even if they put something on Virtual Console, nobody will even know about it because it's just going to get lost in the noise. And I think it's very, very clear, if it wasn't already clear before, it's very clear now that they need to come up with a completely different way of marketing these things. And I think, if not the way that Europe does it, where you have a week of WiiWare and a week of Virtual Console, I think at the very least, Nintendo should have, look, on Monday, release all your WiiWare and DSiWare stuff, and on Friday, release your Virtual Console stuff. I mean, you have to set it aside so it doesn't get lost, and then they can keep it going.
I mean, I really agree, because there's no reason not to at this point, with the maturation of WiiWare, especially as it takes on its own identity, to say, we don't have to conflate these things. We especially don't have to conflate it with DSi. I mean, let's have
so
differentiated
different.
Promotion, like you said, you can differentiate the releases, and maybe, maybe come up with some more unifying sort of themes for release games together that have some sort of relationship to each other, so it's an easier kind of hook.
Mm-hmm.
It embeds itself into people's minds more readily, because it's these three games that all have something to do with each other. Maybe they're all from Capcom on the Super NES or something.
Yeah, package them, put them in as a bundle, get the entire trilogy.
That's a whole other issue. I mean, it, in the sense that
that's not
if there's an issue of the commercial side is not doing as well for them, at what point do you say, do we stick with the current pricing structure, for instance? There's an argument maybe to say they could end up changing that, because if it's not performing as well as they like.
They could. I mean, Xbox, the community games this fall, when they get changed out, they're going to rename them to indie games with the new dashboard update. Mm. And, who cares what they call it? But part of the update that they're doing is they're slashing, and I mean slashing, the prices, the pricing tiers on those XNA games that people submit.
Right.
And we've seen, especially on PlayStation Network, you see deals on the download games.
Yeah, they'll have
sales. You're starting to see it a little more on Xbox. But this is the first time where I've seen them actually go across the board and just say, we're just going to restructure the pricing on this whole system. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's going to pressure Nintendo to do the same thing, but I think it will kind of show the validity of that kind of approach.
There's some arguments that you could make for that in specific cases when we look down the line of what's already happened. For instance, Neo Geo. I mean, there was a time when Neo Geo, in the post-WiiWare era, was like carrying the service. It was actually, you know, the most frequently updated console. And it just stopped.
Right.
Even though there's plenty of prominent Neo Geo games that they could have continued to release, you know, but it seems like it probably just wasn't making it in the market. And, you know, maybe 900 points was more than what people were willing to pay for those games.
Far,
and,
far overpriced.
Oh, yeah.
And Commodore games are overpriced, obviously.
Well, you could certainly make that argument, but clearly people feel it more acutely in certain the case of certain platforms than others. And in the case of the Neo Geo, it just seems to me what makes more economic sense to completely abandon ever putting any more Neo Geo games and say, all right, let's bring it down to 700 points, release a few more, get it going again, and see what happens. I mean, you think the overhead costs involved in putting these games on there is sufficiently low that, you know, it'd be worth the risk, but the behavior doesn't back it up.
Yeah, I think the overhead is more than people realize, because, I mean...
I think it must be.
Yeah,
if you look at the behavior,
I mean, even
in Japan, where they put many more up, I think even there, you said some people could seem to characterize it as being completely trivial, and I just... I can't see that can be true when you look at how things actually are.
Well, they're retuning the emulator specifically for each game.
Mm.
And there's a lot of coding that goes into that. And then they have to test it and actually make sure that the game runs properly.
Yeah.
And if they don't, they have to go back and fix things. And that can be a painstaking process. And, you know, the other thing is that you do have to get the game rated by the ESRB. And there's a cost associated with that. I mean,
although,
it's probably
not that
high.
Nintendo seems to have had quite a cavalier attitude with that. I mean, look, Nintendo have got lots of money to throw around, I guess, so it's not the best example.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were quite happy to re-rate Earthbound for apparently no reason. So,
yeah, that's true.
Not apparently a significant cost for them.
Yeah, yeah, but maybe for other publishers. Right,
but yeah, I mean, we were talking Neo Geo or Commodore 64 or whatever it may be.
Yeah, I think you know, even in Japan, I think Nintendo hasn't done nearly as much with Virtual Console as they can. I mean, when you look at stuff like the fact that there still are no N64 games on the service that support the controller pack, which is the little memory card that went into your controller. And that is one of the biggest reasons that third-party games have been shut out of the service so far, is that most of them, probably 75% of third-party games, relied on the controller pack because it was off-board memory and it allowed them to manufacture their cartridges at a lower cost.
Yeah.
And Nintendo tended to put on the cartridge saving in their games, meaning that they didn't need the controller pack because they could afford to do it because they're first-party and they gave themselves a deal.
It was like trivial things like, I think Wave Race 64 had some controller pack stuff you could do, like saving settings.
Sure, there's ghosts in Mario Kart 64, and when those games do appear on Virtual Console, they just disable that feature.
Yeah, that functionality isn't there.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, but that does not seem like it would be hard to emulate, you know, to get that working.
Not really, no.
I just don't really understand why we haven't seen any motion on that, because, I mean, I can only assume it's just because in Japan, there wasn't nearly as much of a third-party library worth re-releasing for N64. Whereas in America and Europe, it was far a much bigger slice of the pie.
Well, because the N64 was just much more of a success in America and not so much in Europe. But, you know, that you did get Western-developed games that were pretty good.
Yes.
I can't go, I guess if we're talking more regional differences, I can't go through this discussion without mentioning the fact that, of course, the PAL Virtual Console is a disgrace.
Because, sure.
Because it has all these 50 hertz issues with Super NES isn't so bad, N64 isn't so bad, but especially for Genesis and NES, you're mangling these things simply because it's adhering to how they were when they originally came out, which I think is a great shame because, you know, one of the great things about the Virtual Console for me, having got a Japanese one, is it's like, oh, I can play these games the way they were meant to be played, you know, which of course I wouldn't have had with the NES when I was growing up. So I think they kind of missed a trick there. I mean, I guess there are maybe some issues involved with that, but it's a great disappointment, and it is the kind of thing that matters to a, you know, a significant portion of the people that buy large volumes of these games.
Sure, which is us. I mean, I've got over 50 Virtual Console games, and and that's kind of what I wanted to segue into now, because I mean, as many complaints as we have, and you know, we may be worried about where it's heading if they don't make some changes. We may be worried about the trends and the quality and the quantity of games that have been coming out over the past few months, but I do want to stress that the reason I care is because I think Virtual Console is one of the best things Nintendo has ever done. It is incredible. The execution has been all over the place, and I have a lot of complaints about it. But I wouldn't have spent $300 on downloading these old games if I didn't think it was an awesome idea, and if I wasn't happy with the quality of the way they play, and all the nice features about being able to suspend your save state, and now, you know, with the SD card especially, it's much more convenient to have a bunch of these on there. I think Virtual Console is amazing. I mean, and I obviously I've spent a ton of money on it because I like it. I like having access to these games. I like having them readily available. And I like being able to explore games that I didn't ever get around to, or it wasn't possible for me to play in the, at the original release.
Well, I mean, I practically bought a Japanese Wii for the sole purpose of playing the Virtual Console games. I mean, that's, you know, and then there's all the money you spend on the games. So clearly, this is very important to me, because I do generally like the way games were, you know, to such a great extent. And because I was an import gamer, because my NES broke very quickly after we bought it, there's so many games I missed out on. So it's just fantastic in that regard. And I think it's and I think in a way, I mean, obviously it's part of a wider thing with Xbox and all that stuff, but it's an important moment in terms of the maturation of the industry, you know, because obviously, you know, music and films, you know, you can get old films for new formats or very easily. You always have been. Yes,
it's a very good point.
When you went to CDs, when you went to DVD or Blu-ray, now, you know, there's no question of, you know, whether you can watch something from the 70s anymore. You know, whereas there was this sort of thing of almost like, well, the games of the past, they're technically dated, and so they kind of fade into this obsolete category. Well, they don't, you know. I mean, these, a lot of, you know, there's real classics. They're still fun, you know, and there's no reason why you shouldn't, you know, why it shouldn't be available for people to play today. And so I think it's a great sort of advancement in the industry that you get to a point where it's like, yeah, you know, you could see, you know, how things were, you can play them easily available, and you know, kind of preserve in a way that just beforehand there just was no culture of that in gaming, really.
Yeah. I mean, my Wii is a museum unto itself.
Yeah.
And if not for Virtual Console, John would have never played Shoiniki.
True, exactly. So, I mean, that's one of the, you know, founding pillars of this podcast. So yeah. I think definitely it's had a huge impact.
No, it has. I mean, this is very indelibly associated with this podcast because, of course, you know, when this started, we were 6 months away, and it was a topic. You remember Mike saying, "Well, they'll never bring Sin and Punishment out," and, you know, and of course they did.
Yeah,
which is
amazing.
Yeah,
one of the best things Nintendo has ever done.
Yeah, I mean, when they first announced the service, I couldn't believe it. I was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe Nintendo's actually doing this because it makes so much sense." But furthermore, I mean, all of these games from Japan, I mean, to me, that was even more surprising, you know, because there's no reason really why they have to do that.
It depends on what you consider from the point of view, you know, this idea that, you know, there aren't much costs involved. It's like, well, why not?
Well, there would be with Sin and Punishment, I think.
Well, but Sin and Punishment, I don't think there was, because they did already...
Well, it did have a lot of English, but...
Because all you had to do was localize the
menu options, yeah.
Yeah.
It was the faith that there would actually be people to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was. It's not a matter of the effort to localize it.
I don't think it was even that much of a leap of faith, because they knew it had kind of at least enough of a cult following that could probably pick up.
Nintendo doesn't cater to cult followings.
Yeah, not typically.
But it's such an about face to their previous policies. I mean, Nintendo has been tolerant of the import scene for a long time, especially with their handhelds. But there is a very, very big difference to not locking out your system, or in the case of GameCube, making it really easy to circumvent the region coding, the region lock on it. There's a very huge leap from that to actually selling import games to your customers on an official first-party basis, which is what Nintendo's done with Virtual Console. It's really unprecedented. I mean, it's pretty insane to think that Nintendo of America is selling untranslated Japanese games to their American customers. That is just unfathomable 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
No, exactly. I mean, that is really excellent. And I mean, that's the thing. I think there's just so many positive aspects of what they've done, you know, sort of on a personal level, like I said, on that sort of broader video game cultural level. That you've got to say to yourself, this is one of the best things that's happened to gaming for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. especially over the past generation. Because, and it's kind of complemented what's happened with the Wii, which has, you know, kind of gone away from traditional gaming experiences to some extent, because you know, for me, I've still been able to, you know, enjoy a vast range of the most, you know, the most traditional experiences anyway. But one thing I think is really interesting, that when you look at some of this stuff, like particularly the case of Wario Land and Punch-Out, is I think Virtual Console has changed people's perceptions about what certain kinds of gaming experiences are supposed to be worth. Because I think the problem with Punch-Out is like, well, you know, I can buy that game for 500 points. Why do I want to pay $50 for it?
Yeah.
You know, because there's this thing now that the price point, it's not about the fact that, you know, you've got all new art assets and all new graphics edge, or there's some sort of association with the kinds of gameplay experiences. You know, this, well, if I could get this experience on a handheld, or I can get it on VC, Xbox Arcade, or, you know, WiiWare, even if it's sort of a new retro game. Yeah, that's something that Virtual Console has been very much a part of. And I mean, in a way, it's kind of sad, because you wonder how many more Punch-Outs and Wario Lands we're going to get, where you get these lovely new graphics and it's, you know, really your rigorous kind of package that may or may not sell that well at $50 because of some of these attitudes. So that's kind of the dark side of it.
Could be. I mean, at the same time, a lot of people from the very beginning have said that Virtual Console stuff is overpriced. And when you have a basis of comparison, like putting stuff on, I mean, you can get Final Fantasy VII on PSN for $10, and that's easily the most expensive game on that service. Most of them are $5. Mm-hmm. When you get a PS1 game for half the price of an N64 game on Virtual Console, people say, aren't Virtual Console games kind of overpriced? And then you look at, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog is $8 on Virtual Console. It's $5 on Xbox Live Arcade. But then, God, the difference in quality emulation is so huge.
Well, that's another thing you
have
to say. I mean, it is the actual performance here is so good.
I would say impeccable, really.
Yeah,
definitely. The quality. So I think Nintendo deserves a lot of credit. And Virtual Console does some amazing things. And I have to say that, you know, even if they, you know, even if they come out next Monday and say, well, you know, you might have noticed there's no Virtual Console games lately, and that's because we've decided to stop releasing new games. We're going to stop supporting it, you know. You still got at least 300 games to go back to. And, you know, somebody will be talking about a game, and I'll get interested in it. Now, they'll basically convince me that, hey, this is a really cool game, and I'll find out it's on Virtual Console, and I will go and spend $5 on it to check it out. And it didn't come out that week. It came out 2 years ago. I didn't pay any attention to it at the time. But, I mean, that's, you know, we've gotten so many great experiences out of Retroactive. Exactly.
Yeah, well, I mean, really make something like what we're doing with Retroactive possible for the start. Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about it.
I mean, you can take a kind of a historical tour and also say you can completely trace the how game design has evolved since, you know, the late 80s, effectively, in a lot of the games that we do. And that's the kind of thing that before, it just wasn't going to happen without Virtual Console.
Or not evolved in some cases.
Exactly. But it's always something to discuss about it, though.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that Nintendo has really missed an opportunity to do, is to give, you know, to recommend or suggest tours through the Virtual Console library. You know, if you like this game, here are two or three other games that you may not have heard of before that are similar that you might like, or even to do kind of wine pairings, you know? I mean, everybody said, well, when, what was it, Smash Brothers, you know, when Smash Brothers came out, they should have released the original Smash Brothers for N64. It would have been easy to do, and they failed to do that, and they've done that with actually several games. They've failed
but
to do that.
But it's kind of spotty with that, isn't it? Because there was some kind of tie-in with Super Punch-Out and Punch-Out and a few others, but then you've got, like,
arguably,
you know, there was no Mario Kart to accompany Mario Kart Wii. There was, you know, as you mentioned, with Smash Brothers. Well, the most sort of tied in was Metroid. Yeah, when they did Metroid, Super Metroid, leading up to Metroid Prime 3, Corruption coming out of retail. That's probably the most kind of into it they've ever got, like, as I could recall. It just does. I don't know. It just generally seems to be a bit of an absence of thought and effort on that promotional side. I mean,
yeah,
it really does.
It seems like it would be something that would be so easy to do. I mean, I thought that whole Metroid tie-in promotion was brilliant.
It's curious. It's really mystifying the way Virtual Console is run. I think on a technical level, it's fantastic. On a marketing level, on a selection level, it's really a mess. Not just bad, sometimes it's good, but it's so totally inconsistent.
I think one of the sort of the scarier things, really, talking about the very recent stuff, is, you know, they decided to give VC Arcade the platform of being a GDC announcement, and so the fanfare of that. And in Japan, there are 29 games for it. In America, there has been one game added after GDC. One. Coincidentally,
I think we have seven total.
I think it's six. And from a certain point of view, that game was not added after GDC because its logo was displayed behind Mystery Water at one point because it was Space Harrier. So you could say it was merely deferred to several weeks later. So, I mean, the point is, if you want to see the divergence of the US and Japan, the VC Arcade is, like, really scary because it seems like, you know, Japan, obviously they've had these scores of Namco games, so it seems like they kind of tap Namco to fill their schedule for like 4 or 5 months. But there was also more games from Sega. This week was an arcade version of Ninja Gaiden came out.
Oh yeah, that'd be cool.
I mean, it's a totally different game. It's like a brawler but from the NES game. But, you know, there is more coming. They're proactive. So, I mean, that is, as the latest addition to the service, as a portent for where it's going overall, that is not good.
It's a bit worrisome. But at the same time, I would say, you know, Virtual Console Arcade debuted around the same time as DSiWare. And again, I think Nintendo chose their priorities. And they said, you know, we can't really make a big deal about both of these at the same time. So we're going to have to pick one or the other. And I'm not really sure why they feel that's necessary. But that does seem to be the intention. So I don't know. I'm really eager to see what happens on Monday, because if there's still no Virtual Console games, people are, you know, there's going to be a buildup of an uproar, I think, from the fans who've really, I mean, this has become part of our lives. To me, I get really excited on Monday morning to go check that. Mm-hmm. I understand why they don't just dump 1,000 games at once. I understand why they trickle them out the way they do. I mean, think about the blog posts for Smash Brothers. Every single day, I'm just glued. I'm staying up till 2 in the morning every night. Mm-hmm.
Just for, like, this time, there's a banana that you can slip on. That was great. I got this profound nostalgia for that time of my life.
All right, well, I don't know. You guys have any closing comments before we move on?
I guess the one thing I want to say is, someone who has access to Japanese Virtual Console, is it does have a lot more games. But there's some of the thing about that is there's a lot of games that would never come out on the American or European virtual consoles for various reasons, probably, or you wouldn't be desperate for them to come out. First of all, you've got a lot of kinds of games that just, you know, you couldn't work as import titles because they really would have to be localized. So you're talking about the Fire Emblems and things like that, and I mean, you know, many other RPGs. Yeah, I think there's even like text adventures on, or a sound novel. I mean, there's some weird stuff on there, much more niche than you'd find. And then there's like the multiple versions of games and stuff, and loads and loads more scrolling shooters, which, you know, people seem to think they've got enough of as it is, by and large. So it may the numerical disparity may somewhat overstate how much better it is. Mm-hmm. Is all I'm kind of trying to say. But I think one of the reasons for that, I guess, is because where are the American or European sort of analogs to those games?
Right.
The games that we were playing that they weren't, they're not on Virtual Console apart from like Booger Man. You know, that's the Clay Fighter. You know, that's the sum total of Western, you know, the individual contribution of Western gaming to Virtual Console is stuff like that. You know, and that's the sad thing. I mean, I guess some of it is like sports games or what. I mean, you know, could you think of any really good examples that we're missing out on?
Off the top of my head, like Excitebike 64, Western developed.
Yeah, that was my left field, yeah. I mean, I think we've got a shot at getting that eventually.
A lot of Paradigm stuff, like Pilotwings 64.
Yeah,
Beale Adventure Racing. You know, I mean, there's so many.
On N64 is the real place where you miss see the Western stuff, right? Like Body
because,
Harvest.
Because during the SNES era, there wasn't huge Western development infrastructure.
But you know, I mean, think about. But the problem is, so few Western publishers are even involved. You know, what have EA put on there? I mean, you know, EA must have a pretty sizable backup.
Beale Adventure Racing.
EA made a lot of Genesis games. You know, yeah. And I mean, they didn't. Yeah. You know, for instance, I mean. Why isn't there just an old John Madden on there? I mean, they didn't have licenses. There is no issue.
That's a good point. Or Madden 64.
Yeah.
If you have Tecmo Bowl, why can't you have Madden 92? I want to play with the Bills when they're a Super Bowl team. Give me something.
There might be something with, I don't know, with the current license for Madden.
Well, you know that EA can't have anybody to compete with them, even themselves.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm getting at.
You know what? I guess it was stuff like Lemmings, you know, things from
yeah,
Britain,
sure.
You know, Bullfrog, your Peter Molyneux's old stuff. I mean, there's stuff. There is stuff, you know, that was, you know, more ours that the Japanese didn't have. And that, in many ways, I think is the reason why it's sort of the disparity is as big as it is, because it's so Japan-centric, the Virtual Console. I think that's a shame, because when I talk about the cultural thing about gaming, the Western part of that is really kind of deficient.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when the Commodore 64 games came out there. I was like, really? It just seems like such an odd thing to put on there.
It's cool. It's cool, and I mean, I'm glad that Europe did it first, and it's kind of nice to see them do something enterprising.
Where's the Spectrum?
Where's the Spectrum? Well, Atari's 2600. I mean, you know, if they actually went 200 points on it or something, I mean, you know, why not?
I would pay 200 points for a very small number of Yar's Revenge and stuff like that. I would.
I'd be hard pressed to pay 200 points for any Atari game. I mean, we forget how primitive they were.
Primitive, yes, but often fun.
I'd pay 50 really? Points. 50 points for any 2600.
Ouch.
Bid them down, John. But that's the thing. I mean, on this whole topic of, like, you know, putting a more Western platform, like, obviously, I mean, Commodore came, but, you know, after VCR came, I'm just like, is there ever going to be another platform?
Yeah.
I think they've already got too many platforms and not enough games on each one.
The last thing, I think that they're actually bringing PC Engine games to PSN.
They are, yeah. So in Japan, they'll have all the TurboGrafx stuff on PSN as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they bring some of the, like, you know, some of the really obscure PC Engine games out.
Well, it is. I mean, Hudson, you know, if you want to talk about this WiiWare thing, I mean, they are the ones that really just stopped. As soon as WiiWare started, they stopped doing Virtual Console, basically.
Yeah.
The only games they have put out on TG16 since WiiWare launch are import games, i.e., you know, ROMs that they'd already done for Japan anyway. So, and in Japan, they continued to support it robustly until relatively recently. And I mean, at this point, with well over 120 games in Japan, they may just have literally run out of games. But, you know, in America, they just said, no, that's it. Forget, you know, we're going to do Bomberman Blast, Tetris Party. You know, that's what we do now in America, whereas they carried on in Japan. So that's very tangible example of what we've been talking about the rivalry between the two.
Yeah, I just, to me, that seems like an unnecessary rivalry.
It does, intuitively. It
is
really
probably good. Nintendo's fault, just in the way that the whole program is structured. But the thing is, we're just guessing, because the way that all that is done has been a secret really from the very beginning. You had stuff like Capcom saying, well, we wanted to put Bionic Commando NES on Virtual Console, and Nintendo said no.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't tell us why. It's just weird stuff, you know?
Very
like,
odd.
It's all very mysterious and behind closed doors, and I just don't really see why it needs to be that way.
Yeah.
I mean, Hudson was the only company that would even tell us what they were planning to release on Virtual Console, and then they stopped doing that.
Well, they got tired of telling us.
Well, because they kind of just stopped releasing them in some of the...
Yeah.
In Japan, again, different approach, because they've always said this is what's coming out this month.
Even, Nintendo said that.
Yeah, this for the whole service, for everything.
Okay, well, that's as much as anyone should say about Virtual Console in one sitting. So, we're going to take another break and come back with a bit of listener mail. back to the third and final segment of Radio Free Nintendo. This is listener mail, and of course, you can send in your listener mail to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. John Lindemann has the first letter of the week, and it's a doozy.
Adrian from Birmingham, England writes, I've just been listening to the Out of the Game podcast, and the guys on there were talking about how their perspectives on reviewing games changed after they left journalism and moved into game development. They mentioned, for example, how criticisms they had made of games when they were journalists turned out to never be a matter of stupidity or ignorance on the part of a developer, but always born of necessity due to various constraints, be they technical, financial, or time-based. Rather than being derisive of a developer for a certain game design flaw, would it not be fair to call it a regretful choice? I can barely read it with a straight face, but do you think any consideration should be given to the difficulties game devs face, or is it simply that the product should stand for itself in all cases? In many instances, it is very easy for the reviewer to point the finger at what should have been done or changed, but rarely, if ever, is it as simple as it seems from the outside. By analyzing game design issues, are your reviews in any sense targeting developers and not only consumers?
Okay, wait, pause.
Yes.
That's the end of the letter, and before we jump into the fray here, mm-hmm. I just want to say, Adrian, thanks for the letter. It's really interesting, and I think we have to be careful here because Adrian is asking like three or four different things, and he's setting them up as to kind of be either or, but really this is not as bipolar as it sounds, the way he's asking it.
Oh, no, I'm taking this super bipolar so we can yell all we want.
James, I know you've been chomping at the bit all week to talk about this, so
good Lord.
Set yourself up and let's hear what you have to say.
Well, when we first got this question, I commented that it almost reads as, your game is bad and you should feel bad. But first off, to note that their quote that none of the design flaws they've pointed to are out of ignorance. No, there are ignorant developers out there. We've seen their work. So that's right out the window. But if you're a good game developer, which clearly they must not be, if this is an issue they run into, you develop something based on the constraints you have when you begin the project. You know what these constraints are. Mm-hmm. If you know you only have 6 months to make a game, you don't try to make an ambitious action-adventure title. You become creative and design something you can do well within that time frame. Right. Failure to do that, it's just you're setting yourself up for failure, so it's still your fault.
I think you could imagine, though, that sometimes these constraints are rather more fluid than they should be because of something that will happen with the publisher. You know, maybe they'll pull your funding to some extent, or they'll cut your funding, or they'll move your release date around because something else happened to some other game, so they want to push something up or push something back. Or, you know, so these are things that the publisher
would be responsible for. But the publisher is part of that relationship.
Certainly, but the point is that he's making is in some cases, I mean, to me, it's a question of how you phrase something in many respects and all that, because I think there is occasionally a presumption in favour of, you know, well, this is because the developers are stupid, or, you know, I mean, the word retarded is thrown around incredibly liberally, especially on podcasts. And it's, you know, and regardless of how offensive or not you find that word per se, is not particularly appropriate when talking about, you know, why something came about. Because the fact is, for a start, I mean, it doesn't really matter why it came about from a consumer point of view.
If the game is bad,
it either works or it doesn't. But equally, why, if it doesn't matter, should people so frequently assume that it's the part of personal deficiencies on the part of the developer? I mean, it's just sort of cynical and sort of petty.
From having edited very, very, very many reviews and written quite a few myself, my stance on this has been for a long time that you should not talk about the developer in a review. And we're talking about reviews here, and what I say is the review is about the game. It's not about the studio. You don't speculate on what happened in the development cycle. You don't speculate on what went wrong because you don't know, and it doesn't matter, okay? But to say that the game has design flaws is not a personal attack against the people who made it. You are criticizing the game. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely every reviewer's right to say, you know what, this isn't designed properly.
But the reason why we get into this probably is because sometimes the phraseology is such that it could seem like a personal attack on the developers. And I mean, that should be eradicated.
If you say it's a product of poor design, then yes, it is a negative commentary on the developer. But
smart people can make poor designs. I'm not throwing out yo mama jokes. I'm saying you didn't do your job well enough, or your intentions were not carried through.
Yeah.
But see, I don't think using phrases like an unfortunate decision do anyone any...
No, the regretful choice thing is pointless.
Well, because it may not have been by choice. It may have been by sheer ineptitude. It may have been by any number of things. Again, I mean, that is speculation in itself.
Right.
For example, I mean, I will throw out the conduit. A lot of people were saying about the conduit, you know, you had kind of two sides, like, oh, they suck. And then the other side saying, oh, well, you know, the devs, they don't have a lot of experience.
Yeah, you have all these people who get invested in the story of how the game was made and the people who make it. It's like, okay, on a human interest level, I think all that stuff is great. When it comes down to reviewing the game, I don't give a fuck if this was made in outer space. I care about, is the game good? Why is it good? What's good and what's bad about it? Should I buy it? Is it fun? You have to be critical about the game, and you have to set aside all this other stuff. It doesn't matter if I'm friends with the president of the company who made Too Human, okay? When I say that Too Human has really serious issues and probably should not be played by a lot of people, that doesn't mean that Dennis Dyack is a bad person or even a bad game developer. It means things didn't turn out the way he wanted them to. I can guarantee that.
I mean, it's a project.
But I don't
it's...
care. Whatever the original intention was back in 1995 doesn't matter, because the game that came out at the end really does not live up to anybody's expectations, and on its own merits, it has serious problems.
I mean, you have to bear in mind that, I mean, it takes a lot of people to make a really good game. It also takes a lot of people to make a really bad game.
Yeah, it's been intensely collaborative effort in any event. I think the thing about this is a lot of this that goes on outside of reviews.
Yeah, like this conversation's here.
Podcasts, message boards, blogs, all this kind of stuff, your commentary kind of stuff.
And casual commentary.
Yeah, and you know, and that's where it belongs. You know, really, you shouldn't encroach into the review space.
Absolutely.
And where it has, I think that's wrong. But I think the reason why it may have done is not only because there's been this growth in the commentary aspect. You know, there weren't podcasts to do this and blogging and all that, you know, so many years ago to sort of feed it. And the second part is, you know, developers are getting more personally prominent themselves. You know, people...
Celebrity culture.
They have their own blogs. They're out there putting themselves out there at events and keynotes and all sorts of things.
Yep.
Well, it was the whole... I mean, it's the Out of the Game podcast. That's exactly what you're talking about.
These are people that have their, you know, to some extent have their jobs in game development because they were a personality in the gaming media.
Yeah, and
right. So I mean that intersection is very vividly demonstrated there.
So I see this is where I find the most troubling comment there is that they seem to have deduced that, oh well, maybe this was just harder than we thought it was, therefore all the problems we ever saw as reviewers were due to constraints.
So, see, James, what you said earlier is that these guys must not be very good game developers. And I don't think we have enough information yet to make that determination, but I will go back and say I don't think they were very good game reviewers if they're now going back and saying
Yeah, because
this.
Clearly the implication is that they were doing what we were just saying they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it is something. This is where I agree with the sentiment expressed in this letter from the point of view that it's too often in all walks of life, as well as in gaming, that anything that ever goes wrong is the result of personal idiocy, deficiency, you know, there's just people that are just wrong in the head. They're just, you know, incapable of doing things. And rarely is it that simple, and rarely is it that personal.
Well, all right. Here's what I would state. If there is anything in any function of life that fails at almost completely everything it does, then that has to be incompetence. That can't just be environmental factors.
And the game you are referring to is...
King of Clubs.
Yeah.
All right, yes. The people who made that game don't know what they're doing.
I would say every single person who works for Zoo Games is incompetent at their job because they have never produced a title with any redeeming value.
You don't have any way of knowing that every single person there is incompetent.
But it's clearly, you, by their results, you could say, well, as a collective, they're not delivering.
Absolutely.
But there's a big difference between incompetence and what, you know, what he's referring to in this particular letter, which is about ignorance or, you know, outright idiocy.
Sure. I think there are a lot of vicious personal attacks in the gaming industry that are completely unwarranted.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm with Greg on that part, but I'm also agreeing with James in that, yeah, when a game is really bad, that's someone's fault. We don't have enough information to know whose fault it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe we should say the person
games
at the top should at least take responsibility.
It's important to re-stress the point in terms of a review, in terms of strictly in a review, you know, which you're primarily you're writing recommendation. It is immaterial. What?
Right.
And it's not our job to spare the feelings of the developer either.
If you plonk down, you know, $30 for a DS game that ends up being a complete dog, you don't really care terribly much whether they made a good fist of it or whether they were phoning it in from the start. It's crap.
Right.
Or whether or not they were just complete fools and just don't know what the hell they're doing.
I mean, in the review space, it's immaterial. So I just think, you know, I think that some of this is a question of tact. And then some of it is just, you know, like I said, I just don't think it belongs in reviews at all.
Right. And you do have some reviewers who say things like this, you know, personal things about the people who made the game or whatever. And they make these blanket statements. And that is wrong. But at the same time, you also have a lot of game developers who read there's no such thing as an objective review, but they read a review that is only about the game and they take it personally when they should not. And
that's one of the issues I'd like to bring up too, is that I think Adrian assumes that we don't talk to the game devs, or there's some big divide between the people that make the games and the people that write about them. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, especially the more PR stuff you do, the more kind of intimately involved you get with the kind of inner workings of any game design, any game development project. I mean, you start to do interviews with people and you start to kind of know people that are personally involved with the game. You're not just this kind of, and you can't help that.
And that stuff is fostered by the publicists because they want to engender a compassion for the people who make these games because they want it to affect the reviews. And it's our job as reviewers to not let that happen.
Well, and it's hard because, you know, at E3, I went to a booth of one company. I'm not going to go into who it was. Then I had reviewed a title they did that was not good, and I had just recently given it a relatively bad score. And I noticed that one of the people who worked there on his credit list was this title. And I'm thinking to myself, well, shit. And, you know, introduced myself, went through it, and he was a really nice guy, but going back and reviewing that game, I probably would at best give it the same score now. But it's hard to just dispassionately review a game.
And it's hard for a game developer to dispassionately read a review.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the hardest part. But also, I mean, to be fair, yeah, I mean, because it does go the other way. I mean, people, not just the fans, but, you know, developers themselves or, you know, other commentators or whatever will often, you know, make similarly tactless remarks about reviewers. I mean, so it's an unfortunate sort of cycle.
Sure.
Lair's a great example of that, where they blamed the reviewers. No, your game was bad and you poorly executed motion controls.
And then that's a red rag to a bull, isn't it? It's kind of like, well, all right, you know, you started this, we'll finish it. You know, like,
and now Lair sells for what? Like,
It's one of the figures of ridicule in the gaming media.
I have a funny story on this topic. I was at a Nintendo party at E3 some years ago, and not too long ago, I guess only a few, but I met a guy from Nintendo Software Technologies, and I think he was a producer or an assistant producer there, and you know, he recognized my name. And as we're shaking hands and getting acquainted, he says, "Oh yeah, you really ripped apart Metroid Prime Hunters." And I was like, "No, I didn't. I mean, I was like, yeah, I had some problems with it. I told him I thought you repeated the bosses too much or whatever." But I go home, I was like, I was wondering, like, did I really rip it to shreds? Because I remember liking the game and writing a pretty positive review of it. And I go home and I check it, and I gave it an 8.0. All right? And I read the review, and yeah, there's a lot of praise for it. I say it has the best online multiplayer of any game Nintendo's ever put out, and this and that. I mean, it is technically amazing. It's really cool. It's a great, it's not a Metroid game, but it's a very good first-person shooter, and it's really impressive stuff for DS. And this guy, the producer of the game, very smart, intelligent guy, read this review and came out of it thinking that, man, I really hated it, because he took it personally. We need to move on because we have other letters here. There is one element of the letter that we haven't read yet that I want us to address briefly, and that is the part where Adrian says, by analyzing game design issues, are your reviews in any sense targeting developers and not only consumers?
Absolutely.
My answer to that is yes. Hell yes.
Absolutely.
We're targeting developers, not attacking developers.
Don't do this ever again, essentially.
When I write a review, am I writing it to the developers as well as our website readers? Hell yes. Every time. Because I know they read it.
Yeah.
I want them to read it. And I have words for them. And they can disagree with me if they want to. But if I know they're in my audience, yes, I have a message for the people who made this game. And it is, you need to fix this and this and this.
Mm-hmm.
If I think I know what can make it better, I'm going to tell you.
Well, in terms of addressing game design issues as well, I mean, that's not only something that a developer is going to, you know, be able to understand or whatever. I mean,
no.
If you didn't address game design issues when criticizing a game, it'd be nothing but a list of assertions.
Yeah.
It'd just be, the game is good because I like it. The gameplay is good. I'm not going to explain why.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of being a writer and being a good writer and thus being a good reviewer is that when you see something that is good or bad, you have to talk about why it's good or bad, not what happened in the development process that we got this result.
Yeah, or speculate on that, or theorize.
What about it is bad? Well, and if it's bad, how could it have been better? Or in what way is it bad?
That is just as relevant to consumers as it is to the developers.
Well, it's not just relevant to that developer, but in fact, it's relevant to any developer who knows about that title, because they can apply that same lesson to their work, too.
Yeah, the thing is, too, it's like you have to realize on any game project, you're essentially locked in a room with that game for 2 to 3 years. So to get perspective from other people that have been playing all the other games that have been released in the genre in that time is crucial. I mean, I'm sure you would want that kind of feedback.
The good developers want the good and the bad feedback. They want to know, they want it straight up.
Yeah.
Tell me, what do you really think? When you hear that phrase from someone, you know that they actually care about what they make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's the key.
Okay, guys, we got to move on. Thanks again for the thought-provoking letter, Adrian, and I hope you'll continue to write in. Now, the next letter is from Knuckles Toledo. I'm wondering if this might actually be Knuckles from Toledo. Writes, hey guys, my Wavebirds are dying. I was wondering if there's a way to use my classic controller with old GameCube games.
No. Afraid not.
There should be, but there's not.
However, the funny thing about the Wavebird is its value went down as the GameCube started to die off, and then it shot right back up as the Wii
yeah,
came out.
Yeah, because you can't find them anymore.
But
you know, Knuckles should know that you can use wired GameCube controllers, and you can find those really easily. So I know it's not as cool as using the wireless, and maybe for your room setup it's not as convenient or practical, but that option is there. You can even probably still find cable extenders
and
shit
actually,
like that. Yeah.
They still make GameCube controllers now, and they have a longer cable than the old ones did.
Yeah, in Japan they do, at least. They've got the white one.
I think
they've
started doing that here now, too.
You can import that.
I'm not sure how the build quality is, because I only used it briefly, but there is a wireless GameCube controller by a company called Cyclone, Psycloone, that really is very closely mapped to what the GameCube controller looked like, except for a stupid D-pad, but I can't remember what it was, that I thought was pretty decent.
And there are a number of third-party.
Yeah, in fact, there's more of them now.
If you really want to experiment and try to find one that's good, you know, there's a lot of options out there.
I seem to recall that one being pretty good and being cheap, like $15.
And James is now an expert on controller knockoffs.
Yes.
having reviewed the wand.
We just funnel them all.
It's funny because I have a long-standing hate relationship with third-party controllers. Because back in the day, we had I'm not sure if anybody is familiar with this particular N64 controller, but it didn't have the trident shape. It only had the middle one.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that guy. We had one of those, and then we had one more conventional third-party N64 controller, and then two regular ones. I remember whoever got the crazy half-trident one. always felt jobbed.
So yeah, I mean, it's going to be extremely difficult to find a real wave bird at this point if yours are breaking, but I think you do have a fair number of other options, and hopefully you can find something that's decent. And I did take a look at that Cyclone GameCube wireless that James was talking about, and it looks nice. I mean, it looks close to the original, so if it works well, that might be a good way to go. But unfortunately, you cannot use Classic Controller with GameCube games, and that is, I guess, due to the fact that once you boot into GameCube mode, the Wii controllers cannot be detected at all by the system.
Yeah,
so
it is a GameCube at that point.
It's not something that Nintendo could feasibly fix with a firmware update or something, because it's just kind of built into the way the system works at a very base level. So unfortunately, that's not going to happen in the future, I don't think.
I would say just go to your local GameStop and look at what they have there, because last time I was at one, they had like 9 different wireless GameCube controllers. Just find the one that least offends your eyes.
It'll be hard.
And your hands.
Because there were some hideous ones.
All right. Well, the next letter, Greg?
Yep. This is Stephen from Madison, Wisconsin. And you know, it's one thing that occurred to me when WiiWare and later DSiWare were announced was that it could be used as sort of prototyping
for
service.
Clocks.
Build part of a game, see if it sells, then build a full version of it if it's a hit. I believe Johnny mentioned the developers of Grooving Blocks said something like this to him. Do you think this is a good idea? And do you think there are any games on the service that you think a full version could be in the works for? I'd love to see a full version of Pictobits with additional modes. So, yeah, I mean, I could see the logic. I mean, my favorite example of this, which is a bit different, is Geometry Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, obviously we got the Wii Geometry Wars out of the, Retro Evolved on Xbox Live Arcade. And, you know, it was one of my favorite games for the system.
It actually started out as sort of a bonus game in Project Gotham.
Yeah, it did.
Racing.
Yeah.
But then they put it separately and somewhat expanded on Xbox Live Arcade. And yeah, it got to be so popular, they put it on a disc. They put it out as a disc on other systems.
Yeah.
Wii and DS. So that was awesome. And yeah, I do have... Let's just say that I talked to certain people at E3 who assured me that Geometry Wars is possibly coming back to Wii.
Let's hope so. That would make me happy.
There's some hope for that. No guarantee at all, but it's being considered. And I would say that since I was mentioned in here about Grooving Blocks, that project is still going forward, and they are making a disc-based version of Grooving Blocks. And I've been in touch with the developers. I've put in some interview questions to them, and they have not gotten back to me. So I'm going to touch base with them, and hopefully we can get you...
Ain't that the way.
And that'll be, I think, the first time it'll be available in Europe. I don't think it's ever come out for the shop channel.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's a really cool game. It's fantastic on WiiWare. I'm curious to see what they're doing to it to make it work as a full price or, you know, maybe half price.
I think
price.
You could just do a lot more with the music because you've got so much more memory.
Yeah.
You could add a lot more content to it by just simply adding songs, for
well,
sure.
Yeah. Listen, I think the idea that downloaded games would be used as sort of test beds sort of started out of PC small download games, so stuff that came up on Steam. And then, you know, Nintendo talked about it when they announced WiiWare. I think they announced it at GDC, didn't they?
They did.
Well, there's a certain irony to it in Nintendo's case, because most of what they've been doing is the reverse on DSiWare, where they actually pare it down.
Yes, yeah. All right, we're gonna release...
Especially on DSi.
...stuff that you already have, like clocks and calculators.
But bits of it. But, you know, the bits of WarioWare that they've released, or the...
Master of Illusion.
The bits of Master of Illusion, the stripped-down Puzzle League... Mario, Dr. Mario.
Game & Watch.
Yeah, they're doing Game & Watch in Japan. And Electroplankton is getting dissected for Japan.
Oh, yeah,
that's
well.
Right.
So this is a very prominent trend now. They're doing it in the complete reverse, so sort of trying to make more of your money back on some of these games that have already been completed. So it clearly could work both ways.
It's not really what Steven's asking about, but, you know, World of Goo was supposed to be released on a disc in Europe, and I think that never happened.
Yes, that was floated at one point.
Yeah, but they weren't going to add anything to it. It's just going to be exactly the same thing.
Yeah, that was for money, apparently.
It was a publishing deal.
To get funding, that if they could sign a retail publishing agreement in Europe, they could use it to kind of fund the whole project. And I don't know how. Maybe they got funding other ways and they could get out of that. I'm not sure, but I mean, I'm glad it was digitally distributed. I mean, it's a very fine game.
Yeah, and it sounds like they've been very successful with it, especially on WiiWare. So it sounds like they probably, in the end, didn't really need that financing. You know, they've kind of been able to cut it out on their own.
Which I guess it was important for them to succeed on WiiWare because apparently the piracy rates on PC are pretty big.
Yeah.
Well, right, right.
If Lost Winds ever got a full game, they could put it out on a disc and count this as the starting of development.
Lostware would ever get a freaking download sequel? I mean, supposedly they've been working on that for ages.
Well, the joke there being that 2 hours, oh, that must have been a tech demo too.
No, I mean, I think Lost Winds is really cool, and I would love to have a kind of a full-length version on disc, but I'd also be happy with episodic, not that frequent, but, you know, I'd be happy with a serialized
Lost Winds
experience over WiiWare as well, you know, if they would just bring it out. that would be great. I'd be happy with that, too. So I think WiiWare has been a very strange assortment of types of content. I mean, when you look at stuff like episodic gaming, that's really strange that we have an episodic game on Wii that's actually exclusive to Wii with Strong Bad. Well, it's Wii and PC, but now Tales is the same as well.
Tales of Monkey Island, yeah.
And then there's a lot of really weird indie stuff like the Bit Trip.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the biggest thing that the digital distribution platform, the different pricing, the absence of, you know, the retailers being involved, the absence of physical copy manufacturing, all that stuff, is flexibility. And I mean, what flexibility means, you could do, you know, almost anything. So, I mean, I don't see why you couldn't have, you know, what he's talking about, sort of prototyping games, you know, which then could be used, you know, very directly in terms of not just the game idea, but the funding, you know, the revenue that you'd accrue from a successful release could be used to, you know, help finance a full version.
Well, it'll be really interesting if and when we finally get back this Groovin' Blocks interview, because I'm very curious to find out, you know, what was the process, how did, you know, what are they doing to it, what's involved, what can they really do on a disc that they can't do on WiiWare. So I think maybe the best answer to this question is wait for that interview, because when we know more, you'll know more about, you know, how well this really works. So the final letter James has.
So, Hyman writes, "Come on, there's an excellent game, Little King Story, for extreme Nintendo gamers like us who know how to look beyond the kiddie graphics! Exclamation point. The game has been out for over a week now, and not even a single preview, not to say a review. I'm very disappointed with you guys. How can you run a Nintendo exclusive site and miss the best Wii game of the year?" Well, to answer this question, we didn't get a review copy. We didn't get preview material.
I will say, Nick and I and Chuck, we all went to the X-Seed appointment at E3, and they showed us Little King Story for about 5 minutes max. They were showing us a lot of games, and unfortunately, I was looking actually for a, you know, kind of a better presentation, because I wanted to know a lot more about Little King Story at E3. And but I think partially because it was coming out so soon afterward, they didn't want to spend a lot of time on it, and also they didn't have the resources.
It was going to be coming out soon afterwards, but it got pushed, didn't it? That's what happened.
Yeah, it did. It got pushed about a month, I guess.
Which is strange, of course, because it came out in Europe beforehand, and I do own it, and I've talked about it on the show, so I assume this chap hasn't heard it. But I mean, I would have liked to maybe do some coverage of it, but there's a couple of issues with that. First of all, I just haven't played it enough.
Yeah.
Other things kind of came along with Punch-Out and various things, and the other problem with it is with the PAL version is because of this 50 hertz issue. It would be a shame for that to colour my opinion of it when American people are not going to suffer from that. It wasn't a deal breaker for me in terms of sending it back, like with Mad World, because it isn't bordered, but it's still an issue. You know, the graphics are not as smooth as a result, and there's a sort of certain less, the colours are a bit less vibrant without the progressive scan. So that's a shame. But from what I've played of it, I do like the game. I think it's good.
Yeah.
And the only regrettable part of it is the fact that it doesn't use pointer control. And for a Pikmin-style game, when apparently the new play control Pikmin works well. And it's not that the controls don't work, but they don't work as well as they did in Pikmin for the GameCube, because, of course, you don't have a second analog stick. So it's not just that you're going with traditional controls like the original Pikmin, you're kind of going further back from that.
Yeah, and I actually have acquired it, but I haven't had time to actually play it yet. So barring us getting a review on the site in the near future, I will start to hack through it.
And certainly, you know, in terms of this, the graphical style, you know, he refers to kiddie. I mean, I don't know whether I'd quite put it that way, but yes, it is colourful and all that sort of stuff. But
whimsical?
You know,
The king is a child.
I don't think it's so much that it's meant to appeal to children, if you know what I mean.
No,
that's
because
where I don't
think
it's... No, actually, it's rated T, and from what we saw at E3, there's some pretty perverted, I don't know if I want to say perverted, but some pretty bizarre subversive material.
Well, I talked about it on the show about the sort of the polygamy element of it.
I don't see a problem with that.
And even beyond that, I mean, the XSEED guy who showed it to us, he was like really proud of it. He thought it was great. You know, he was like, you know, it looks like a kid's game, but there's actually some pretty adult stuff in here. And
There's almost the kind of the social aspects of the fact that you're kind of, you know, going on this sort of world domination thing, and there's some like religious stuff in it, and you know,
hegemony.
It's a sophisticated game, and the gameplay as well is sophisticated. And the sort of the boss encounters that you have are real, you know, they're unique, you know, because the gameplay is unique. But at the same time, there's something about them of, you know, the sort of traditional boss style encounters from older games. You know, they're tough, and there's a kind of trick to beating them. So it's this is a really, really well put together kind of traditional game. For the most part, so I mean, certainly, I mean, this every review I've read of it is pretty complimentary.
Yeah, it's
and
that's
from
what
I've played of it. It is good.
And that's what actually pushed me over. I mean, this is the kind of game that I'm inclined to play anyway. But I didn't intend on picking it up quickly. But the review scores were just so, well, I don't know what the best word for it is, so just completely overpowering in my ability to resist buying it.
So James has picked it up. I want to pick it up, and I may very well in the next week or two. So 3 out of 4 ain't bad. John, we'll work on you.
Yeah, I'm intrigued now. I will say that. Yeah.
We don't hate Little King Story, and we're not ignorant of it. All right. Well, we need to wrap up the show. Again, thanks to everybody who wrote in. There were some really great letters. And you can send yours again to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And before we go, just want to say, look out for the other podcasts on the Nintendo World Report Radio Network. Those being a Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. There's a great episode with James.
Not too often you hear those two words in the same sentence.
Oh, nice. Oh, you listened to it? Could you feel the neither of us really knew what to say vibe going on?
Yeah, it's interesting. And we also have the NWR Newscast. The second episode of that should be going up fairly soon, I guess. So look forward to that as well. Of course, you can also, if you haven't done this, I should tell our new listeners, because we haven't said this in a while, we would really appreciate it if you use iTunes to look us up in the store there, if you haven't already, and give us a review, even just click on a star rating, or you can even write a note there. That helps us a lot to move up in the rankings, the search result rankings, which helps new people find the show and helps new people find the site, which is good for everybody. And next week, I guess by the time you hear this, you might have a couple extra days to vote on the Super Nintendo retroactive poll. That has been very interesting so far, and we've got a lot of votes. So if you want your vote to be heard, get over there soon.
Okay, yeah, get over there for James or myself. You know what's going to win this week? Choaniki by a landslide vote.
What? Why was Choaniki nominated 4 times?
A last second nomination at the 11th hour.
With 800 votes, Choaniki.
We'll announce the results on the next show. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. We're going to leave you on that note. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So long.
Well, it is a PS2 game put on WiiWare.
It is, which it's not even the first time this company's done this. They brought us the Chocoto blank blank games.
Oh, I can't believe you fluffed Cocoto, James.
Son of a bitch!
Chocoto, it's like chocolate.
I know. Like he's
I'm hungry,
got a cereal
right?
now or something.
You're going to have to do that again.
Chocobo. Sorry, chocobo. Fine. I'll
this
do it again.
This could be the stinger, but you've got to do it again show.
This is the company that brought us the Cocoto blank blank games.